Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Oh, hi there, Al Dukes here. I started my New York City radio career on March 5th, 2001, when I was hired at WNEW to be the producer for the Ron and Fez show. I had been living and working in Tampa, Florida for the previous 7 years. When I left those 7 years earlier, WNEW was a legendary rock station for many, many years. Loved listening to it when I was growing up. When I arrived, the station had flipped to FM Talk with Ron and Fez in middays and Opie and Anthony's in afternoons. Over the years, whenever we talk about working at WNEW, everybody seems to describe it as the Wild West, hence the name of this podcast. To me and to many others, it was the last great talk station in the country. There was a buzz in the building every time you would come to work. Was this the day one of the shows would do or say something that would get them fired, get the radio station thrown off the air? As a producer, would I be the one that would be doing something stupid or saying something stupid that would spark outrage? It felt dangerous to go to work every day. In August of 2002, Opie and Anthony's infamous Sex for Sam took place, and they were fired. By 2003, the station would change formats, and the FM talk industry would be completely dead on terrestrial radio. Each week on this podcast, I will talk to somebody directly involved at WNEW during the FM talk years. First up is Anthony Cumia. Anthony from the Opie and Anthony Show. Yeah, I think you guys got there in 98, and then I don't think the radio station turned into a talk station until 99.
Right. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
So when you got that job going from Boston to WNEW, did you know what you were walking into, that it wasn't a talk station and they were still doing classic rock?
Yeah, we did know that, but we didn't seem to care. At that point, personally, I was just happy to be employed again. After getting fired from Boston. But we knew it was a classic rock station. You know, coming from New York, we were pretty familiar with NEW and what it was at the time. But we didn't know that there would be such animosity from the classic rock jocks there. We didn't know that they were pretty strict about the playlist, and we would be playing a lot of music and not really doing what would turn out to be the Opie and Anthony show. In time. So it was a little tricky when we first got there.
Now, and you guys went right into afternoon drive. Do you know who you replaced? Like what NEW jock was there?
They shuffled around a few jocks. I know they fired a couple too, but I don't recall who was doing afternoons before we got there. Maybe you do.
I do not know who that was, but so you get there, you guys are you doing like a version of the Opie and Anthony show and playing music at the same time?
Yeah. It was very limited to what we could do. The time we got to talk was very limited. You have to play all these old songs and then pop in between when you're supposed to be reading station liners and whatnot, and try to do some kind of shock jock comedy.
And did
so, they so It was a little frustrating.
Did they tell you they were going to flip the station to talk and they wanted to bring you guys aboard first as they eased into that? Or did you go there thinking you were going to be on the classic rock station?
Well, the PD at the time, we had met with him, and he wanted us to do the show we were doing up in Boston, the Opie and Anthony show, a little bit of music and a lot of comedy and talk and whatnot, interviews with comedians and musicians. But I think that he was having a hard time getting that point across to management. So when we got there, we knew eventually we were probably going to be able to talk a lot more. But for the beginning of our tenure there, we kind of knew that we'd have to play these songs. And then it just got out of control anyway. We stopped playing a lot of the songs and we started talking. It was a different time there. But we knew at the beginning we'd have to play a lot of songs and we weren't going to be able to do this kind of show we were doing immediately when we got there.
And what was the situation with Carol Miller in particular? I know there was some sort of argument or back and forth with her. Like, she was very serious about the music and didn't like you guys coming in and trashing the music, because I think you did that at one point as well. Like, you're just like these songs are over with. This is it. This, nobody cares about this music anymore. What was your run-in with her, and why was it on the air? Did you guys come on after her?
Yeah, Carol was one of the jocks there that just were, you know, an institution. They were all these classic rock jocks that ended up at WNEW playing that same old music over and over and over.
But she
again.
Was really into
of
it.
Of course, Opie and myself were like personality-driven radio. So, you know, to play the same old Who song again and the Doors and that have been played literally millions and millions of times seemed to be a little, I don't know, boring. So, yeah. But these jocks, it's all they had left. It was really all they had left was this, the tie that they had with the music and the radio station being classic rock. So when we came in there, I think it spelt the end. You know, they kind of saw the end of this whole thing coming. And some of them were really resentful. And Carol fell into that category. She was kind of resentful of the Opie and Anthony show coming into the church of WNEW. And we used to have these arguments and fights in the hallway about the shows. She would have a snide remark about our, you know, shock jock type pee pee poo poo humor, what she called it. And we would talk about how, you know, nobody gave a shit about another Led Zeppelin song. It just made for a very uncomfortable atmosphere. She came on after us. And at one point, the program director actually said to Carol, she had to wait in the office when we left the studio and walked to our office so we wouldn't meet in the hallway and have one of our loud discussions in the middle of the station with the rest of the staff watching.
Were there any older rock jocks that embraced you guys when you showed up there?
Yeah, Pat St. John was really cool. Still is, you know. Pat's a good guy. He was really nice to us. They used to leave faxes and they'd send faxes and leave notes about Opie and Anthony and say, you know, leave, you suck. So some of the jocks were really pissed. Scott Muni too.
He liked you or didn't like you?
What's that?
He liked you or didn't like you?
Oh, he liked us. Yeah. Scottso was a very old jock. He remembers sitting down with the Beatles, you know.
Like, yeah, breakfast like with
really,
the Beatles.
Been in the business for many, many years. And we'd go into his office and sit down and he'd tell us old stories about radio. It was pretty cool. Actually, you know, there was some good things that came out of being at that classic rock station when some of those jocks were there. But some of them were just, you know, old jocks that got pushed aside, ended up at NEW, and knew it was probably going to be the final hurrah of their career.
And then when that whole thing finally ended and it flipped to FM Talk in 1999, what other local shows did they bring in at the time along with you guys?
God, there was various iterations of a sports talk show.
Oh, Sports Guys.
In the morning was the Sports Guys, yeah. And I think they called it the Sports Guys because it was constantly changing the people on the show. But that was, you know, that was kind of their attempt at doing, I don't know, something that competed with Mike and the Mad Dog and other sports programming in the morning. And then I guess in after, yeah, Middays was, who was that? The Radio Chick was mornings after a while.
Yeah, she got moved around a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And then... oh, they brought in like some syndicated programs, or not really syndicated, but from DC and stuff.
Yeah, I think that was a little later on when they brought in Don and Mike. Are you thinking of?
Yeah, yeah, maybe that was later.
Yeah, that was a little later on.
Well, so, Ron and Fez.
Yeah, Ron and Fez
were on also, who were just great. That made for a really good combination. They came on after we did.
The first, when I got there in March of 2001 to start with Ron and Fez, they were on middays. We were on noon to three.
Yeah, that's right. Oh my God. I've blocked all this out.
Yeah. And then they moved us to after you guys, which was seemed to be a better fit. And I think the radio chick was on middays. And then there was like a best of O&A / Ben Sparks DJ segment.
Oh my God.
From like 2 to 3. Right. So it was like, it was best of O&A. And then at like 2:45, it would be Benny W, where he would play like some live Kinks song or something.
Right.
And then into you guys at 3, and then Ron and Fez at 7. But I remember there were many times like sitting in the back with Ron and Fez, you know, on the surface, you might look at their show and say, oh, they talked about, you know, your favorite candy bar when you were growing up. Obviously it was much deeper than that and more fun than that. But there were times when like you guys were doing such crazy shows that Ron would be sitting back to go, how are we supposed to go on now and do our topics when like you had the 55 gallon drum challenge going on. I remember that day in particular, Ron says like, they're shooting girls with Uzi water guns filled with pig's blood. And now we're going to go in and do what's your favorite candy bar? Like we can't do that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what?
I guess they started out as ronandfez.com.
Yeah. Overnights.
Yeah. Yeah. That was doing overnights. And, yeah, it was like kind of somehow related to the brand new internet thing that was.
Yes, the internet.
Yeah, that crazy new thing. And yeah, then it kind of melded into more of a show that was conducive to being alongside the Opie and Anthony show at the time, because they started doing some crazy things too.
Well, I think they started that because, you know, of where, the, you know, they were following you guys and you had to have some sort of something in the beginning of the show so that it wasn't like an immediate different show when your show ended at 7. What was your show prep like back then? Like say at the height of Opie and Anthony on WNEW, what was that process like? I know you had like Rick as a producer, Ben was there, Stinky. What did people contribute to the show? And what was that? Was there talking before the show? Like how did you guys figure out how you were going to fill your 4 hours?
Yeah, it was I think it was pretty original to radio to do prep the way we did. It was a minimalist kind of a thing. We would go over all the newspapers, all of us would go through the papers, find stories that we liked, something we could riff on or do a bit about. And then Rick and Stinky Garrett would would add some ideas of sound, maybe what music to put to it, sound effects, kind of a thing. And we would just roll like that. We rarely talked about what we were going to talk about on the air. It seemed to ruin the spontaneity of it. We liked being given a situation and then just dealing with it live as it happened. That seemed to be the best way to do things. It was surprising to everybody, including ourselves. And spontaneous in a way where the audience knew it was, a lot of these things were being constructed right in front of them. So it was a pretty original way to do radio. I think that was part of the success story. But yeah, it was a pretty minimalist approach to show prep.
Now, one of the things when I first got, like, I grew up a huge Howard Stern fan, as I think you were a big listener as well. And when I first got to NEW, you know, when you were a big Howard fan back then, you hated everything else. Everything was a ripoff. Like, I thought, oh, Opie and Anthony, these guys are ripping off Howard.
Yeah.
You know, when I very first got there. But one of the things that I learned from Ron and Fez was they would do a lot of sort of wrestling type things where the audience wasn't in on the I don't want to say fake part of it, but it was more like created drama, like wrestling might be. And I never thought that that was a possibility. And having listened to Ron and Fez do it so smoothly, I started to think back on the Howard shows that I listened to. And I thought, well, was any of this stuff fake or set up? Did you guys do any of that on Opie and Anthony during the NEW years where there was like set up, where you would set up either the producers to do something stupid on purpose or a listener, or was it all sort of real?
Yeah, it's a great point about Ron and Fez. They were the masters of that.
Masters. I mean,
you know, they would play a work to the end. And it was really entertaining. We didn't do that. I don't think we could do it like that. That's how good Ron and Fez were at doing that. You look at it and go like, we weren't people that could do some type of scripted thing or just even an idea that we knew beforehand. We were going to talk to a guest and tell them to do a certain thing and have a villain. It just wouldn't have come off sincere, looking sincere. No, we just rolled with whatever really happened. We would agitate people. We would get people annoyed, but their reaction was absolutely honest. We would take people and kind of manipulate them into doing things that maybe they didn't originally want to do, that we knew was going to be entertaining, that would make some drama for us, but it was all on the up and up.
And I always wondered this, and this is maybe a question for Opie, but you might know as well. Like, I always wondered, did Opie know that Ron and Fez were using me to screw with him, or did he really think I was a weird guy?
He really thought you were a weird guy. I mean, that was an incredible work, and it was hilariously funny. Again, it's textbook Ron.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
Doing something like that. I mean, I don't know till just recently, perhaps, people in the audience and perhaps even Opie would be like, how is Al still doing something in radio? Like, how would someone so odd be able to hold down a job that long? But yeah, it was just the brilliance of Ron and you being dedicated to the bit.
Yeah, even like when I had got drunk that night and they tricked me into making out with a man, and then I kicked over your foosball machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Or your foosball table. Then Ron, like the next, the following week, Ron's like, hey, you know what? You ought to see if we get a company to bring a pinball machine in here. He goes, it'd be awesome. And then he's like, yeah, on the air, just say you bought it for Opie. I was like, all right. And then Opie smashed
yeah,
it.
Smashed it.
And then the guy was like, did you guys smash my pinball machine? Yes. Yes, we did.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
But like, that was Ron. Like, Ron wouldn't even let you in on it sometimes in the office of what he was doing. Like the less people that were in on it, the better for him.
Yeah, he the puppet master, as we called him.
There's also there was one other time that I remember when I was on the air saying that I wanted to be Opie's friend. Why isn't Opie my friend? And like Opie's girlfriend called in and was like, "What is wrong with you?" I was like, "What's Opie really like at home?" And I never knew whether he knew what we were doing or if he didn't.
No, absolutely not.
See, I felt like you were more in on it because you would hang out sometimes at night and you would you watch what they were doing, you know, moving their chess pieces around.
Those were some of the greatest times I remember at NEW, where after the show, going back into the office, we'd hang out with the ONA show people. You know, I'd hang out with Garrett and Opie and Ben, and we'd drink back there and smoke, and I'd play video games. And then I'd pop into the Ron and Fez show and hang out there. And you know, they had a lot of audience members come up there. And we'd hang out and again drink and smoke, and it was like a party up there.
As I said, like anybody I talked to that worked there during that time, they'll always say it was some version of, you know, the Wild West. Like there didn't seem to be anybody in charge.
Yeah,
you know, we would do those drinking shows on Friday night, and I would expense $300 worth of liquor, and it would get paid. It was so bizarre. Like nowadays, you don't even get anywhere near doing that sort of thing. Yeah, did you have a lot of interaction with like Jeremy Coleman, who was the program director? Ken Stevens, I think, was the GM at the time. Were they very involved or very hands off?
No, they were really hands off. It was. I think they considered NEW a station they didn't have to worry about. At the time, there was this thing where Mel Karmazin and some of the other executives over there would put a general manager in charge of a bunch of stations. Like he would get a region. So, Ken has to take care of Washington, D.C., New York, Philly, things like that. And they were so busy with other stations, and they figured that NEW was kind of on autopilot. So they didn't have a lot of interaction with us unless there was a problem. And there turned out to be some problems over the years. but I was really kind of the steer clear of the boss guy. Opie enjoyed more talking with Ken and Jeremy about radio and things, more of a traditionalist. I just thought, like with every other job I had, the less you saw the boss, the better.
Right.
Just do your job, go home and, you know, go, whew, I didn't have to see the boss today. That's kind of how I felt. There were weeks that would go by where we didn't see the GM, and Jeremy was, you know, we got to the point where we were able to kind of manipulate him. He wasn't really a guy that could, dominate employees. No. So we were able to do things that, you know, it was really the last gasp of the shock jock era, and the ability to just do some of the most outrageous things with relative impunity.
I said it's like the only thing I can compare it to is in sports. Like if you are a really good athlete, your coach and the owner can do nothing to you.
Yeah,
because you're so good and you're not replaceable. And that's right. The situation you guys were in there. Now, yeah. one of the things, you know, in a lot of the country, when Howard was humming along and you guys were getting those same stations that Howard had, you would get the afternoon show. In New York, you know, Howard had his own thing going on at K-Rock. But there was a time when, there was rumored that you guys were not allowed to say Howard Stern's name. And I can say that was true, as I had to work the dump button. And we had to take out any reference to Howard Stern, including you going, "Hoo hoo, Robin." And it was funny when I first got the job doing the dump button, Craig Schwab was doing it prior. Yeah. And he was told to take out any Howard Stern references. And I know there was a little while where you were calling him Big Bird, and that was going through as if, like Craig Schwab had no idea that Howard Stern was Big Bird.
Yeah.
was there an incident that a particular incident that caused you guys not to be able to mention his name?
Yeah, there were a few. There were a few that built up to it, but there was a proverbial straw in that whole thing. Apparently, Howard's daughter went to the Jingle Ball for what station used to throw that?
Z100.
Z100, right? Another station from the past. Yeah, used to throw Jingle Ball. It was a concert, I believe, Madison Square Garden. Just a huge thing with.
They still do it, by the way, every year.
Do they? Wow.
Yeah.
So yeah. So apparently Howard's daughter went there and maybe had imbibed some alcohol or something else. And we had a lot of cop fans. Oh my God. So many of NYPD guys were fans of the ONA show. So they would tell us things that were happening. We got a call from Keith the cop, and he said, yeah, I'm getting a report that Howard's daughter is at the hospital, and you know, they're Howard's here, and Beth, not Beth at the time, it was his
Allison.
Wife. Yeah, Allison. Allison. they seemed very upset. Like, he was giving us a blow-by-blow description of what was going on, and it, you know, it just turned out to be the daughter, probably, like girls do, were out having a good time and maybe drank a little too much, and they took her to the hospital. But we thought it would be a great opportunity to do a bit. So we got on the air and started playing music that you'd hear at the Jingle Ball at the time from various pop artists and doing sound effects and voices of Howard and drunk girls. And it just, it was really funny to us, you know, especially both of us not having kids or anything.
Right.
And that was it. Howard just went right to the top and said, I want you to fire these guys, like, get rid of them. And while they couldn't do that, they assured Howard that we would never, ever again speak his name. And we were told not to say his name anymore. And it made a lot of animosity and resentment. We didn't like being told we couldn't do something, especially something like that. It wasn't like the FCC rules or company policy kind of a thing. It just was a very personal thing that we weren't allowed to mention Howard, kind of a power play. But we snuck it in as much as we could. There was a point where we would just play the clip from the Kid Rock song where he said radio edit.
Right.
Radio. Yeah. Oh, so radio edit was saying this. And then they said, no, you can't even say radio edit on the radio. You can't say radio edit. So it really got out of hand with management. That was probably up until we got fired. That was probably the biggest thing that management had to deal with, was us talking about Howard, and they would be dragged in and have to explain to Mel and other people why we were talking about Howard.
Which is funny because, you know, he spent his whole career trashing Imus and ManCow and
all these
guys along the way.
That was a little odd. Yeah, we thought that was a bit hypocritical, but, you know, I guess when his kids were involved, that's where it usually goes really bad.
There seemed to be, and we were saying earlier how, like, if you liked Howard back then, you hated everybody else. But there was a time when there was starting to be a shift where people were listening to Howard in the morning and then you guys in the afternoon. If NEW put you guys on against Howard, how do you think that would have gone? Do you think you just would have split the audience and it worked better being on in the afternoon?
Yeah, they knew it worked better in the afternoons for us. And not to go against Howard. I don't think Howard was just a juggernaut. There was no way a personality driven talk show could beat Howard. And I loved the show we were doing. I had the utmost confidence in it, but I really wasn't that confident we would ever beat Howard. But we would probably take away enough numbers where he wouldn't be number one anymore. And that was their big issue. You know, Howard being number one, you're able to get that sales revenue. And it was very counterproductive to the company to have us battle each other.
Yeah.
So having us in afternoons and Howard in mornings was kind of that was the solution to that whole problem. The only thing was they had a hard time selling both of the shows. That was the reason they gave us for not being on the same station as Howard, because logically we should have been doing afternoons at K-Rock while Howard did mornings at K-Rock. But they wanted to kind of keep it a music thing. And they said we would never be able to sell anything. You guys are on those lists that, you know, the big sponsors steer clear of shock jock shows and the controversy. So they kept us at NEW, kept Howard at K-Rock, kept him in the mornings, kept us in afternoons. You know, you got to keep them separated.
Yeah, you were doing live reads for Stacker 2.
Yeah.
The sponsors
are Horny Goat Weed and Stacker 2. Oh my God. It's like, where's the Ford Motor Company?
Yeah, for some reason, they don't want to be tied to you guys.
Where's Dell Computers? I don't get it. Why am I selling this magic elixir that gives you erections?
And how did you become the person that was using the sound effects? You know, normally that goes to a producer, you know, not one of the two main hosts. How did you end up doing that?
Yeah, that was something I loved doing. And that's a kind of a tribute to Fred Norris, man. I mean, like you said, being a Howard Stern fan, I was probably right there as one of the biggest fans. Like if you took the category of the biggest Howard Stern fans, I would be in there. And the way Fred worked those sound effects was so funny. He could take something, a situation that was kind of funny, and just put it over the top hilarious with the sound effect. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the guy that was able to trigger those sound effects. It's a lot faster. It's a lot more in line with, you know, the vision I had for a bit or a segment or a phone call, to throw those things in at the absolute right time and the right sound effect. And it just made things hilariously funny. And I never really trusted anyone else to be able to pop that in at the right time. So with technology, the way it was too, it wasn't like you had to shuffle carts and grab a cart and put it in there. It was all digital, so it was a press button thing, and I knew exactly where certain effects were on the board, so I could hit it really quickly. It didn't really take away from me concentrating on talking or doing the show, so it worked out both ways. I could still be one of the hosts and still work that goddamn sound effect machine.
Yeah, that instant replay machine. It would have different banks, right? There were like 50 buttons, and then you could have different banks of those 50 buttons. Did you have it divided up? Like, for instance, I remember one time, like you used to like to play all those clips over a music bed, right? And I remember there was a time with the Michael Jackson molestation stories, and that was big in the news. You came back with a Michael Jackson song, and all the drops were about that. So did you have like a bank of like, you know, you like, yeah, were they divided up into categories? In banks?
The first bank number one was the ones I would use most often. And then the rest of the banks were pretty much topic driven. Yeah, like if somebody was caught, like Michael Jackson with children doing inappropriate things. That was a bank. There was a bank about homosexuality. There was a bank about minorities. There was a bank, you know, there were certain banks that were, you know, conducive to the topics we would talk about. And and just watching people like I don't know, anybody that was in the room, Steve C and Ben, Rick, just watching them laugh their asses off at a sound effect, a movie drop or something, was that was gold to me.
Like, I have still never seen The Godfather, but I know all of the lines.
Wait, maybe you are a weird guy. Who hasn't seen The Godfather?
Too long. It's 3 hours long.
It is very long.
Let's talk about the dump buttons. So, so weird. So Craig Schwab, who was the assistant program director at the time, he was doing the dump button. But then I moved. Honestly, I needed to get off Ron and Fez. I was like too stressed out from that show. It was making me crazy.
They rotated people in and out of that show quite often.
I know, like looking back, some people think I like worked on that show for 5 years. I was only there like a year and a half.
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
Before I moved out of it. So I was like, all right, well, I could do this. I'll learn the dump button. And Craig Schwab taught me the dump button, all this stuff. And, you know, when you guys would have comedians come in, it was much easier to run the dump button because they were the stuff that they would say was so blatant that it was
right.
easy. But like you and Jimmy were so good at walking that line. And, you know, whoever was working the dump button really had just, I think it was like between 3 and 8 seconds to make a decision on in the context, do we know what this means? And then the other thing was, I was just getting done training with Craig Schwab. And then that Friday was going to be Sex for Sam.
Oh God.
And I said to him, you're really going to, one of my very first days is going to be Sex for Sam. He goes, listen, that's the easiest day. He goes, they're super aware of what they're saying because of the content that it's going to be no problem. So of course that went on and there were things, words that came out over the air that I dumped out of that were graphic in nature. But
right.
I always wondered after that ended, when the Sex for Sam thing happened and it blew up, you know, what came out of your speakers was not offensive. What happened in the church, I guess, was offensive.
Right.
So were you mad at anyone in particular that happened? Were you mad at me? Were you mad at Paul Mercurio, the comedian who kept pushing and pushing and pushing? Were you mad at yourselves for doing that? Like, where were you when that whole thing ended?
All of the above. I was just like, generally angry that the whole thing happened, and you know, you try to cast blame, and then after a while, after a few years actually, you start realizing, oh yeah, I have to be responsible for my own actions and what happened on the show that day. So I did go through a while though where I was just pissed at everyone, Mercurio, and like, what an idiot. Why did he do that? Why did he say that? Well, he could have just left, and the coulda, shoulda, wouldas going through your head. And I don't know. I think though, it was kind of the whole thing was coming to an end. That whole shock jock thing was really in its death throes.
But did that kill it? Or was it, you think it was heading that way prior to Sex for Sam?
I think that had something to do with it. I think also the Janet Jackson thing had something to do with it. This weird fake morality that started oozing into society. The cancel culture, if you will, you know, even looking back at the original days of what we call cancel culture now, just the very few people that are supposedly offended that want people gone. That's pretty much what we were in. We were constantly trying to avoid that. But we were constantly trying to get people to try to cancel us. That was the thing about shock jockery, was that you wanted to push it so far that you were right on the brink of being fired every day. That was a goal. I want to come so close to being fired every day, and that way I know I'm doing my job. And, you know, I think everybody that plays that game is eventually going to step over the line. And that's what happened to us.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you feel like you have to top what you did last time. And these shows being on every day, 4 hours a day, it's like, what else are you going to do? But that being said, there was an energy in that place. And for those few years where you walked in, you didn't know whether it was going to be the last day of the radio station. You didn't know if somebody was going to be physically injured. There were no boss. There were no bosses around. There was something very interesting about that does not exist anywhere today.
No, it was a culture, a corporate culture that just you do not see anymore. I occasionally stories pop up about Infinity Broadcasting and all of the iterations of Infinity over time when other companies took it over and they'd sell it and merge with this one and that one. Regardless of what flag it was under, every so often a story comes up where you'll hear there was a problem at a Christmas party or the culture of some of these meetings or retreats that the GMs would go on and think, and all these little dirty stories come out of harassment and other things. And every time I read it, I go, I believe this 100%.
Right.
Like it was just, it was a men's club for the most part. It was, it was like Mad Men. It was really that last gasp of that men walking around, dirty jokes, slapping ass, inappropriate language, all that stuff that now is an instant firing offense was just commonplace. And funny is sometimes I'll read who was complaining about it and think, I remember seeing you at some of those parties, laughing, drinking, palling around with everybody. So why now do you look back at it as a problem? Everyone was in on it. Everyone knew what was going on. It was a very debaucherous time and place to work.
Well, yeah, there was an area at NEW where you would walk down the hallway of the offices and then you would go through this door and that's where the studios were. And the computers back there, the screensavers were women with vegetables in strange places. And management was just like, that's the creative people. When you go through those doors, those were the doors. They're like, when you go through those doors, those are the creative types work back there. So anything goes.
Could you imagine something like that now? No. Someone's computer with some literally pornography on it.
Right, pornography.
In the workplace. And just.
Then we had another computer that was just all stolen songs from Napster, which we would just do whatever we want with on the air.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's really amazing to think that we've changed so much that just would not for a second be accepted.
Now, one of the things when you guys were fired and then sat out a couple years and went to XM, I think it was you or Opie that I heard a conversation about that said, like, the difference between being at WNEW on the regular radio dial versus being on XM. And when you guys first went there, you were even on an additional pay channel.
Yeah.
That only like your dedicated fans listened. You didn't get to accidentally piss somebody off that didn't know what the show was or
right.
That someone couldn't accidentally stumble upon it to get offended. Did you find that? Like, do I remember that from you guys having that conversation?
Oh yeah.
That like, in even where you are now at Compound Media, like those are your hardcore people.
Right. Yeah, that was something that was, we were pretty concerned about that. A lot of really funny moments came out of a wrong number, you know, somebody making a mistake and calling the studio, the hotline or the request line accidentally and us just rolling with it. And those things just wouldn't happen. Or somebody getting mad. Yeah. We used to get people that called up and said, shut up and play the music because they were pissed that it wasn't classic rock we were playing. And we would go off on them. And you know, people like that kind of combative thing on the phone. And then just getting attention. Yeah. If we did something that offended somebody and they wanted to pursue it, sometimes you'd get press. Sometimes it would make for a great radio segment. But when we went to, XM, subscriber-based platform, that just stopped. And it was something that, you know, we remember liking having in our arsenal, but, you know, we had to move on. It just wasn't it wasn't the same, wasn't the same kind of atmosphere anymore.
And then, and I know the company tried to kind of redo the format again with Free FM at 92.3 when Howard left. But at that point, the format was really dead, right? There weren't many people that could do those types of shows. You weren't really allowed to do the type of shows. And do you think the Opie and Anthony show from NEW was dead at that point? Like, not, as we knew it from NEW, like, yeah, from NEW to 92.3 and those years in between, did something disappear from the magic of that show?
Yeah. A lot of restrictions were put on us as far as what we could do in studio. They started worrying about insurance. They started worrying. We used to do things like the 55 gallon drum challenge that, you know, you couldn't do that. Someone might die. You know, it became something that corporate started getting involved in. They started dipping their hands in, and the lawyers and insurance and management started just saying, yeah, you can't do that anymore. Well, and Opie's thing was always to say, no, your job is to figure out how we can do it. And they said, it can't be done.
Yeah.
And they started restricting us from even having girls undress in the studio and things like that. And that's when we knew that whole genre was done.
Well, that's the other thing, like, even in the early days of the WNEW website, you guys were able to post topless photos of listeners.
Yeah.
All somebody had to do is click that. I'm over 21 or whatever it was. And you click the button. Yeah, that would, like, you would bring that down to a guy who worked in the computer department, and he would put them up on the website. It's crazy.
It was, that was, again, another thing that you just wouldn't see now. But the audience wanted to see it. It was kind of the beginning of that whole thing. Let's put video up and pictures of what used to just be the theater of the mind part of radio. Hey, there's a naked girl in the studio. You know, we've seen on private parts and other movies and things about Howard. But we just figured, let's put it up there. Let the people actually see it now that there's a medium for it. And again, you know, you'd never see anything like that happen today.
I think you guys were definitely early on with the technology, with the instant feedback, similar to like what Twitter is now, with the Pal Talk cameras. Everyone's got cameras in their place now.
Yeah, it's, that was
even the Syndication Underground. People were getting feeds of the show somehow around the country.
Yeah, we kind of started that. I've always been a tech guy. I love it. And when we were in Boston, up in Massachusetts there at AAF, we would take pictures. I bought a digital camera. This thing was a brick. And I had a laptop. And this is, you know, the mid-90s. And I started uploading pictures, digital pictures from the studio of some of the girls that would come in to a personal website that I made. And people loved it. I didn't know anything about bandwidth costs and things like that, or there wasn't really a good way to compress pictures and video. So they sent me a bill for like $12,000 one month. And I called them up. I go, wait, what is this? I'm just putting stuff up on the internet. And they're like, yeah, there's a cost to that. They let me slide on the bill, but that's when I had to start thinking about what I wanted to put up. Because I was just putting up uncompressed video of girls taking showers in our studio and things like that. So I had to really cut back and just start putting little thumbnails up.
And then how did Jimmy Norton become a full-time person on that show? Were you looking to find another guy and he became that guy from coming in and along with other comics or how did that evolve?
Well, I'm sure if you talk to Opie, you'll get a different answer. I don't think I wasn't looking for anything like that. I liked the comics that would come in, that would rotate in and out. But apparently Opie has said, and you could confirm it with him, that he started seeing a rift between the two of us back then.
Oh.
Yeah. And he thought we needed a third person in there to kind of, can you still hear me?
I can.
Okay. I just got a default microphone has changed to something. I don't know. Yeah. He thought that we needed a third person in there kind of as a buffer, kind of, to move the show along, because he assumed we were having an issue. You know, the personality issues between myself and Opie, I don't even want to get into. I've done it enough over the course of the years. But
they're all on time, YouTube.
Yeah. At that time, you know, I was still skipping around. Everything's hunky-dory. And he apparently had some issues with our relationship. So Jimmy had come in with Dice. Dice was going to be in the area, and we loved having Dice on as a guest. And Jimmy was on tour with him, and he brought Jimmy in, and Jimmy sat down. It was just hilariously funny, of course. Like myself, Opie had approached Jimmy and said, hey, would you like to come in and, you know, maybe come in next week? It's the same thing he did to get me on his show.
Right.
And then Jimmy just started coming in. And when it came time to negotiate some things, we got some money for Jim, and he became a kind of a part-time, full-time member of the show.
There never seemed to be like a rift between you and Jimmy, though, which I would have think would have happened if you felt like, you know, there was a third guy coming on and you weren't really all that interested in it.
No, I right from the start, I just knew he was great for the show. He brought certain things to the show that that myself or Opie just couldn't bring to the show. There was a certain honesty. You know, we had done in our radio careers up until the point where Jimmy became part of the show, we had constantly hid things. We didn't know that it was kind of a good thing to acknowledge that a joke bombed. Making fun of yourself, goofing on yourself, things like that Jimmy brought to the show. We were standard like shock jocks, so over the top, always right, always, you know, you're goofing on someone else, never yourself. And Jimmy brought that whole aspect to the show, where a joke would bomb and Jim would look and start laughing. He goes, oof, ugh. and we'd sit there at the beginning. We were horrified. Like, what's he doing? Why would you acknowledge that the joke bomb? And that was his, you know, comic thing coming through. And it worked so well. It really changed the dynamic of the show in a way.
Yeah. And then when you guys were bringing in all those comics, was that, it was sort of like, you know, one of the things that I didn't like about Howard was where he started bringing in celebrity guests. Mm. And I always felt like when you guys are bringing the comics, they would come in and be part of the show as opposed to being interviewed.
Yeah, there could be a comic that, you know, on stage, hilariously funny, the act is great, and then they really didn't have an ability to sit down and just bullshit with guys. Like, that was the biggest part of our show, was just guys sitting in a room and talking about guy things and busting balls and laughing. And you know, most of the New York comics from the Comedy Cellar and Caroline's and, you know, the big clubs in the city were hilariously funny guys just hanging out. So when we got the likes of Patrice O'Neill and Otto and George, Rich Voss, Bob Kelly, Nick DiPaolo, all those guys were just funny guys. And we'd rather have one of those than 10 guys who are going to come in, sit down and do their act and, you know, hand us a piece of paper of topics to ask them so they could just do their act. I think we sold a lot of tickets for these guys because the audience liked them as people and knew when they were talking that they were funny guys and their stage show was probably hilariously funny, even though they weren't doing it on the radio, on our show. And it did work out exactly that way. People became very fond of these guys and how funny they were just being guys. We we loved that aspect of the O&A show, was just the hang out and bust each other's balls.
Yeah, all of those guys. I that was my first introduction to all of those comics. You know, Bill Burr, all those guys was coming through Bill. Your show.
Yeah, yeah. They, you know, at that time, comics looking for any outlet. You know, a bunch of whores. So they'll go on any show to promote themselves. But our show was starkly different. It was a place where they could just sit down, kind of reminiscent of the famous table at the Comedy Cellar, and talk about things, talk about life and, you know, relationships, just hanging out.
Did Tough Crowd come from that, or did your bringing in the comics come from Tough Crowd?
I think Tough Crowd came from that. Tough Crowd kind of spawned after we got the boot.
Because it was all those same guys.
Yeah, it was the same guys, and it was kind of the same thing. Let's talk about what's going on in the news, and in between, we'll rip each other apart. Colin's no dummy. He knew that was a great format for a show.
Another show that would never air today.
Oh, my God. Watching some clips, watching some things from the Patrice documentary that is up on Comedy Central, it was just like the stuff we got away with. And until you see it again on video or hear it on audio, you can't believe it. Like I think of some bits that we did or segments and things we did on NEW that I'm sure were on satellite radio, but they weren't. It was on regular over-the-air broadcast radio. And it's insane to think.
Well, even just in the time from NEW to 92.3, when I was on the dump button at NEW and John Entwistle from The Who died, and a caller suggested maybe Dice Clay would join The Who, and then you were doing all these Who songs as Dice Clay, and you had your own sound effect of a beep, right? So you were doing squeeze box as Dice, but you were saying like puh, then the beep, ussy, right? and that aired like that. But then when we went to replay it at 92.3 a couple years later, I had to go through and take out all of that, like even bleep those fully. So just even in that time, things kept evolving as far as like what was no good anymore or what was okay.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. Some people post videos. There's so much stuff up on YouTube, and they'll post something that I haven't seen or heard in years, maybe a decade or two. And I just start laughing my ass off. And it's funny. It's like, you're laughing. Why are you laughing at yourself? And it's like, no, I'm laughing because it's Dice singing Who songs. Like, I don't think it's me doing it. It's Dice singing Who songs. And it's hilariously funny. So I'll still listen when somebody posts something, I'll listen to it and go, oh my God, how did we get away with that on regular radio? So,
right.
Yeah. I did not envy you guys in the dump room. There was a lot of resentment to you guys, at you guys, but, what a thankless job that was. I have to be the guy that cuts off something that these guys in the studio want to do and the people listening want to hear. And oh, the villains it made over the years.
Yeah, that's why how I knew it was over at K-Rock, when you guys were super nice about it and coming down the hallway and going, hey, we want to play this. Who are these guys? Normally I had to keep this door locked so it wasn't kicked in.
Yeah, the locked door and the key that you turn and the...
Oh, yeah.
The Van Halen song would play from the transmitter.
Yes. Well, I appreciate you... taking time to do this. I really wanted to, like, I think back on NEW all the time and it's what I want radio to be now. And unfortunately it just doesn't exist anymore. Like that format doesn't exist. That dangerous feeling doesn't exist anymore. So I wanted to talk to the people directly involved in what I feel like was that last station. As you said, that was the end of it. That Sex for Sam was the nail in the coffin, as they say. So
yeah. Hey, it was good to be part of it, though, you know, to actually be part of an era like that, you know, arguably started in the 70s with some of these guys, Steve Dahl and, of course, Howard coming up and that whole shock jock period through the 80s and 90s. was huge. There were a lot of copycats. There were a lot of bad people that were just bad at it, forced. But, you know, we can say we were right there on that battlefield at the end.
Right. And do you think, like, is it better? Like, it's like that Neil Young lyric. Is it better to burn out or turn to rust? Like, would you prefer, like, what happened to you or what Howard's doing to his legacy?
I kind of like that we went out the way we did. It is part of radio lore as it goes. You know, I'm still having fun and doing my thing now. So I enjoy talking to people and you know,
how long are you on a day over a compound?
2 hours.
That's the way to do it. These 4 hours shows.
A day, 4 days a week.
Perfect.
Oh yeah. I love it. It's been 7 years now.
You got multiple people. I was like, how's he paying all these people to do these shows?
Yeah, it's, you know, it works.
Yeah.
the place works.
And you do that from your house, or you have a studio in New York still?
No, I got a studio in New York now. I've had that for 6 years. I only did the show from my house for a year. And then we got a studio at 35th and Broadway, right by the Garden, Penn Station. And we do it in there. We have a whole control room, studio set up, a green room, kind of hangout place. I got a lot of really funny people that get it, that aren't afraid. We've been doing these comedy tours now too, where we do comedians of the compound, and we're going all over this summer: Austin, Cleveland, Boston, Philly, and you know, while they're not these giant virus tour things that we had we were doing with ONA, it's great to get out and still see the people having a great time.
Yeah, and you have people all around the country that are subscribers.
Yeah. It all around the world, actually. There's people I hear from Ireland and Australia and Italy. it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Oh, Al, no problem. It's awesome. I love it. Love talking to you about this shit. Take it easy.
See ya.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.